You're listening to the Nahum Siegel Network, and the program is entitled By the Book, brought to you by our friends at Koren Publications, Magid Books. Shlomo Brody is with us. The book is entitled A Guide to the Complex, Contemporary Halachic Debates, Abortion, Stem Cell Research, Conversion Standards, Female Rabbis, DNA Testing, Animal Testing, Civil Marriages in Israel, While Today's Most Hot-Button Halachic Issues Elicit Strong Opinions on All Sides, Few Understand the Halachic Origins of Their Views, Their Historical Development, or Social Implications. Without fully grasping the issues at hand, respectful dialogue between conflicting opinions becomes impossible. In A Guide to the Complex, Shlomo M. Brody presents over 130 of the most provocative, controversial topics in Jewish law today. The book's concise, articulate essays based on the author's popular Ask the Rabbi column in the Jerusalem Post cite sources and scholars from across the ideological spectrum in an effort to increase respect for the diversity of voices in the halachic dialogue. This compendium of highly relevant essays gives an accurate picture of the legal, historical, and sociological factors that are fundamental to understanding halachic debates. A Guide to the Complex is published by Magid Books, division of the Jerusalem Publishing House Koren Publishers. Shlomo Brody is founding director of the Tikva Overseas Seminars for Yeshiva and Midrashah students and teaches at Yeshiva Dakota, also a presidential doctoral fellow at Bar-Ilan University Law School, junior research fellow at the Israel Democracy Institute, and is a columnist for Jerusalem Post, and his essays have been printed everywhere. Shlomo Brody, welcome to the Nahum Siegel Network.
Great to be here.
You know, it's interesting that in the introductory remarks, I said something that I'd love for you to expound on. Without having all the knowledge or as much knowledge as possible on a specific topic, it is impossible to conduct a respectful, peaceful dialogue. Does that automatically tell us that when people are yelling and screaming about a contemporary issue, chances are they don't know all the facts?
I think that's correct. I mean, I think people certainly can have a lot of passion, even when they have knowledge and take a certain, you know, stand on an issue. But I find that a lot of the heated debate and the people that do get so angry on a given topic, they don't necessarily appreciate the nuance, they don't understand the other side, different ways of looking at things. And that's a real shame. It's a shame because we don't have that big of a community. And if we're going to learn how to live together as one community, we better learn how to understand each other and understand where other people are coming from.
If one of the main staples of Torah scholarship is the diversity of opinion, right? Elu ve'elu, and respecting one another's opinion and understanding when one comes from a different point of view, how did we get to the fact, or how did we get to the point where things became so myopic, where if you don't follow a certain regiment or a standard when it comes to controversial issues, essentially you're marginalized in our community?
Well, you know, Elu or Be'elu, I think you're right, is a real important principle. But there are certainly some positions which I think everyone would agree wouldn't be included within the Elu Be'elu category, meaning they're beyond the pale. And that's part of the issue about sort of defining where the borders might be. And then also, ultimately, even when one believes Elu Ve'elu, there is a sense of saying that I can still think I'm right and another person's wrong. The other person may have a legitimate position, but you can still think you're right and wrong. And I think that's actually perfectly legitimate. But it's when we forget that the other person might still actually have something really, you know, interesting and thoughtful and legitimate to say. Well, that's when we get to this type of situation that we're in today.
How long ago did you publish the book?
It was a little over a year ago.
I ask that because it's amazing to me how so many topics are in the news right now. It's probably something you knew as you were writing it, that there's such a cyclical nature to Jewish existence and halachic analysis that some of these topics are either always or at some point are going to be in the news. Are you aware of the fact that now in the United States there's a major, I don't want to say debate, because I don't know if there's enough room on the other side to actually, or strength on the other side to say it's a real debate, but great discussion about vaccinations. And that has seeped into the Jewish community here, that whole discussion about whether a child should be vaccinated or not. Do you feel there's a definitive opinion about whether vaccinations should be utilized or not?
Well, I think you're right. I think a lot of these issues are ones that are going to keep on coming up for many years to come. And that's part of the goal of the book. My own personal opinion on vaccinations is that those who feel that it's not only something which is entirely permissible, but obligatory are correct here. I have a very hard time understanding of those who feel that it, you know, that one shouldn't be compelled to do it, excluding cases, of course, when it's not medically possible for certain children. But I do try, nonetheless, to lay out the different sides of the issue in the book so that at least we can all understand each other and talk on the same plane.
Yeah.
Even though my own opinion is that people really need to get vaccinated, need to vaccinate their children, and that schools would be entitled, in fact, to bar children from entry in order to prevent such problems and outbreaks.
By the way, I should mention at the outset, because there's so many topics we're never going to get to in this half hour, that you do explore a number of issues when it comes to medical ethics, a number of issues when it comes to technology, and many other categories as well. So I'm not, ignoring specific topics for any specific reasons. Some of them may be among topics that are difficult for me, frankly, to get through in a conversation at the moment. But I'm trying to choose those that have either been in the news or that I think would, you know, people listening, you know, casually now would find intriguing. I'll give you another example. I'm sure you're aware of the fact that right now there is a major discussion going on here in the United States about the role of a woman religiously in a synagogue. And I noticed that you have a variety of discussions when it comes to women in synagogue, whether they should or should not wear, or can or cannot wear tefillin. Women reading from the Torah, women participating in their own zimun, the separate seating, how to what degree that goes. Is it just the synagogue or other public places as well? Could you give us a little overview? And I know it's asking a lot because there's so many things involved, but how would you respond or how do you react when you hear about the discussion going on here with the women's role in the community?
Well, to be honest with you, I'm quite horrified by the nature of the discussion right now in the American community, because it's just people are talking in very vociferous, angry tones of voice, and I understand the passion, but it's disappointing that we can't take a step back and look at some of the sources and discuss some of the halachic issues and the issues that go beyond halacha, also issues of values. My own opinion, you know, I tend to be on the conservative side on things, a small C conservative, of course, in this case, because, you know, I very much feel that we need to have support of the Gedolim, Jewish legal decisors, to make certain types of changes, some of which has certainly, you know, garnered the support of such Gedolim. Others, you know, I think it's not there yet. It may never come, but I think we should at least understand where the perspectives on those issues are coming from. I mean, one of the things I try to establish in the book is let's not put together all those issues, which you might call, you know, issues related to feminism or women's and halacha. I think each topic sort of has to be explored on its own. In my mind, there's a big difference, for example, between women's Megillah reading and women wearing tefillin, for example.
Right.
In the former example, I think there's a tremendous amount of halachic support, and both in the sources and even contemporary poskim, which is Megillah reading. With tefillin, not so much, even though, you know, I think an argument might be made. And I think it's important to tackle one issue at a time and for people to understand very well where other people are coming from. I know I should add that, you know, the purpose of my book is really not to give my own definitive opinion, although at times, of course, I do.
Right.
But I don't see myself as being one of those rabbis that can really have the stature to really say this is what should be, but rather to really understand some of the contemporary controversies. And certainly with women's issues, people need to take a step back and understand what's at stake here and what the halachic sources are.
Rabbi Shlomo Brody is with us. The book is A Guide to the Complex, Contemporary Halachic Debates. Is everything included here deserve to be called complex? The issue of the Temple Mount, I would say, is a complex issue. Is everything that you discuss in the book complex, or it's simply, you know, every one of them seems to raise, you know, the attention of people out there, and that's why you might call it complex?
Well, you know, there are definitely certain topics I think it's more of a clear-cut halachic stance, but for the vast majority of them, there's a lot of nuance in the debate. And there is usually, in most cases, some form of disagreement about, at least in the details, if not in the general picture or perspective. And that was sort of the goal, my goal of writing this book, is There are many topics of halacha that are very clear cut. I didn't think another book on those types of topics needed to be written. On the controversial issues, you know, that require some nuance, I thought there was a need to fill in the gap in the Jewish literature on this topic. And, you know, I mean, one of the critiques I've had of the book is that these are essentially 1,000-word essays. And it's very hard to say what Judaism has to say about abortion or arms sales or all sorts of other issues in 1,000 words. But I do believe that you can get across some of the major positions and the major arguments, even in that limited space.
Rabbi Shlomo Brody is with us, A Guide to the Complex, Magid Books. Look at the Koren Publications website, korenpub.com. Yet there are some that can be covered in 1,000 words. For instance, we just concluded the holiday of Hanukkah. Why don't we have a definitive answer halachically in our history whether one must feast and celebrate with a feast on Hanukkah?
Well, I think it just is a fascinating debate about how to understand the nature of the holiday and what it was that we're celebrating and how that gets celebrated. And I think it's one of the great things, actually, that you see within this debate about whether you need a feast, real differences of opinions about whether this was a spiritual victory or a physical victory that we're celebrating. And there are all sorts of different manifestations of how that gets played out in halacha. You know, I think one of the great things about learning Jewish law in depth is that you see it's not just about the law itself, the technical law, what I have to do. There are ideas and values behind those issues. In the case of Hanukkah, it really relates to the essence of what are we celebrating here and how does that get celebrated?
While we're on the topic of Yomim Tovim, holidays, this to me is something that's good for the casual listener to discuss. Let me ask you a couple of other questions. Why has it become such an issue about wearing Crocs on Yom Kippur? If they're not leather, why would it have become such an issue? Was it one person or one way of thinking that made it into an international discussion?
You know, it's really fascinating how that became such an issue because the broader issue of what types of shoes you can wear has been debated for many centuries. I think Crocs highlighted for a lot of people, these are really comfortable shoes. And that doesn't seem to feel like the type of inuim, the types of actions that we're supposed to do in Yom Kippur. You could say that we've always had sneakers like this and the good old Chuck Taylor, you know, Converse.
Yeah.
Might fit in that category.
Right.
It's a fascinating question. Why did Crocs become such a big issue in more recent years? Certainly, Rabbi Yashiv Zatzal had some influence on this, because you know, got raised with him and others. Rav Sternbach and Eidah Haredit in Yerushalayim had his opinions, certainly on the matter. But it's hard to say why. My guess is that these shoes are just too comfortable, and it became too highlight for people. This is a typical type of shoe wear during the week. This just can't be allowed. And it's raised a lot of fascinating discussions about the nature of what exactly we're supposed to accomplish in Kippur as well.
Rabbi Shlomo Brody is with us. You have one question you ask about, can Jewish farmers sell their land to non-Jews during a Shemitah year in order to cultivate it? In a different chapter, you ask, is the practice of selling chametz really legitimate? Are the two related?
Well, I think they're somewhat related in the fact that they're both types of what some call legal fictions or are meant to be sort of loopholes to get around a certain law. And in that respect, there is some commonality between the two of them. And I think people rightly ask a question of these circumstances. Are there really legitimate reasons for employing such a legal fiction or a loophole to get around what seems to be the plain letter of the law? And I think it's a good thing to ask that question because we shouldn't take such leniencies lightly. In both cases, you know, I think there's a legitimate ground for employing the leniency, and there's good reason for it. I actually think that there's better reason for employing the Heter Mechira for the Shemitah year, for allowing cultivation of the land, let's say allowing your average, you know, homeowner to sell his $200 worth of whiskey, whatever it might be. In the case of the Shemitah cycle, we're really dealing with the state of Israeli agriculture, and there's a lot at stake here. I'm not sure there's so much at stake with, you know, people giving up a little bit on their whiskey, although I know a lot of people like their whiskey, and that could make me quite unpopular. But, you know, ultimately, I think both of the loopholes are legitimate, even though I think it's important for us to ask, you know, long and hard when and how we should employ them.
And when you think of the severity of the practice, because people like to cite, of course, that, you know, Shemitah is a has the source in the Torah. We know that the prohibition against chametz is also a source in the Torah and a very serious one.
Right, absolutely. I mean, chametz is quite serious in the Torah, and there are many, many shurim related to it. And, you know, Shemitah is an interesting case because even though it's mentioned in the Torah, there's good reason to think that in contemporary times it's only rabbinic prohibition for various technical reasons you can mention in the book. So in some ways, you know, I think it's actually easier to employ the leniency in the case of Shemitah, but there's certainly many more people that accept the dispensation of the loophole with regard to selling chametz or Passover, but don't like it when it comes to the sabbatical year, the Shemitah year in Israel. And that's an interesting thing to think about. And I hope that when people read the book and they see that, you know, both of these have loopholes that are being invoked here, they should ask themselves, why am I bothered by one and not the other?
Isn't it funny? Isn't it funny? Guide to the Complex, Contemporary Halachic Debates, Rabbi Shlomo M. Brody is with us. You're listening to Buy the Book here at the Nachum Segal Network. You don't have to offer your opinion on this one if you don't want to, because we know opinions on this one, sometimes met with strong reaction. But the whole issue of entering the Temple Mount, this seems to be one, based on what I said earlier in the conversation, where if people only were a bit more educated, it would be a little bit easier to deal with. I say it that way because according to everyone, there are areas of the Temple Mount that would be permissible. And what's not permissible or what's questionable is specific areas of the Temple Mount. Would that be accurate, that the more education on this topic, like you said about all the other topics, the less vitriol there would be about heading to the Temple Mount?
I'm not sure, because it's true, I think you're absolutely correct, there are definitely areas of the contemporary area of the Temple Mount where everyone agrees people should be allowed to go on, at least in theory. But what you have really in this controversy isn't just an issue of Jewish law. It also relates to politics, both Israeli politics and geopolitics as well. And there's also this deeper theological question, which goes beyond the letter of Halacha, which relates to how we view the Mikdash, how we view the Temple Mount, and our human approach to taking, to ascending onto it, which goes beyond issues of law to really issues of how we see theologically this sanctified area. So I would hope that it would help reduce some of the vitriolic debate on the issue. But, Israeli politics and theology are enough to get people going. Yeah. So I'm not so sure it would totally solve those issues, but I truly do believe that knowledge about even the letter of the law, halakha itself, would at least help in terms of ways of thinking about the issues.
Yeah. You have a question about reporting criminal behavior. If someone has evidence incriminating a fellow Jew, he'd report it to the authorities. It seems to me that the attitude in some areas of the community to this question has changed over the last decades. Do you agree with that?
I hope so. I do think so, and I hope so. I mean, I think there's an understanding today that certainly in the Western democracies that Jews live in, we benefit greatly from the police and all sorts of other law authorities. And we need to cooperate to help, deal with those types of issues, criminal behavior, which endangers us, frankly, on many different levels. So my sense is that there's a greater understanding of the need for cooperation from legal authorities. There's also greater confidence, I think, that Jews, when convicted, will be treated fairly within jails and the legal system as a whole. And that's, I think, a good trend. Good sign of Jews feeling comfortable in the countries that they live in, and it's a good sign for Jews to be active and legal citizens and be very much involved in being a part of doing their civic duties. I hope that that's the case, at least.
Fascinating. 134 topics like this, everybody, and one is more fascinating than the next. I heard an interesting story where a great rabbi was about to lose his father. His father was terminally ill and suffering. And his son, meaning the grandson of the one who was about to pass away, communicated to his father from Israel, "I'm going to take a minion of people to the Kotel HaMaravi to pray for grandpa." And the father forbade him from doing so. may someone pray for the death of a relative who's suffering greatly?
Ooh, you know, it's a very sensitive topic. I think that actually the classic Talmudic sources would indicate, as supported in the 14th century by the Ran, would really indicate that a person can pray for someone who's both suffering and terminally ill. Both of those criteria, suffering and terminally ill, to actually die. And there are certainly legal decisors today who feel that way. When I'm asked about the question, though, I usually tell people we should just pray in those situations for God to have mercy.
Right.
And God will decide what mercy means. If that means that they should live, wonderful. That's great. And if, unfortunately, that means mercy, in this case, means that they have to die, then we accept God's decision on this matter and are thankful for the fact that God had mercy on them and preventing them from continued suffering.
Wow.
It's certainly, though, one of the more sensitive topics. It was actually the first question, a serious question I got as a young rabbi, and that question has come very close to my heart for that reason.
Wow, unbelievable. I like to sometimes surmise that some questions or some situations in Jewish law, and I can give you some examples, although I may incriminate myself if I do, are consumer-driven. Certain things are I'll give you a perfect example. I believe it's ridiculous that people will listen to rock and roll a cappella style during Sfira, but they will not listen to cantorial music because there's piano accompaniment during Sfira. I think that's ridiculous because it's, because of the, but it's consumer driven, in my opinion, meaning this is what the consumer basically has brought us to. This is what people want, and this is what ended up being what the market would bear. You have a question about shaving with electric razors, and I seem to think it's sort of the same, that there's great debate about whether it's allowed or not, but more so the consumer, the Jewish man, has indicated that they need an electric manner with which to shave, and therefore it has somewhat for that reason has remained halakhically permissible. Do you agree at all with my theory?
Well, it's a complex issue about what social demands and what the people are sort of demanding or looking for and how that impacts how we interpret classic legal sources. In the case of shaving, I definitely think you're correct that there is a certain perception of a need to be clean shaven. I think many legal decisors also saw that people were just shaving maybe through illegitimate means as well, and that was a bad thing. And we wanted to find a method of shaving that would be permissible, and that would at least be much more permissible, certainly than people just shaving with a blade or a razor. And that is always an interesting factor that can certainly push halacha develop in different ways.
Yeah.
And I think even the question you raised earlier, we discussed earlier about selling chametz,
right,
selling bread for Passover, is also sort of an economic, socioeconomic factor that pushed people in different directions. I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. I think that in some cases it's clear in the Talmud that we care very much about not being overly imposing on people when possible. I think we care about people's economic stability and other factors as well. But we have to be careful, and particularly lay people, I think, have to be careful about not trying to push certain matters too far, because there are sometimes, in the case of razors, for example, I think it's perfectly legitimate. And I think a very good case can be made to allow electric shavers. In other circumstances, much more difficult to justify something and probably shouldn't be justified. And I think that part of the conversation we need to have today, when people have a very conscientious of the consumer factor and the social factor, is that the legal decisors should be sensitive to the needs of the community, and the community should be sensitive to the requirements of Jewish law. And if we're all sensitive to the various different factors, I think the end result will be a very good thing.
At one time, the greatest poskim were known for that, to be able to adjust when necessary, either for a community or for an individual, obviously within the parameters of halacha. Right?
Yeah, yes, that's true. And I still think the great poskim today know how to do that. But things have gotten a lot more complex today because of the internet and globalization and the whole phenomenon of being able to give an individual ruling given a circumstance becomes very difficult when, the next moment it could be publicized on Facebook or some blog or anything else.
Yeah.
That sort of complicated things in very interesting ways. about the nature of how halachic rulings are given today. And in fact, you know, today I think one of the struggles that rabbis have is they know that no matter what position they take, if they're asked a question, someone's going to say to them, I saw three other opinions on the internet.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's really changing the way halachic decision-making is being given. And, you know, it could be a bad thing because people can undermine the system. I hope that'll be for a good thing, that there'll be a certain amount of transparency and rabbis can say, listen, I know there are other positions out there. I know you know that as well. But this is what I truly believe, and I think you should follow this position. Ultimately, I think there needs to be a certain amount of intellectual and religious maturity of people basically saying, you know, I understand that there are other positions out there. That's a good thing. But I've decided to accept this rabbi's position or this position for whatever reason, and I should stick with it.
Rabbi Shlomo Brody, it's called A Guide to the Complex, Contemporary Halachic Debates. We touched on some of them. There are over 130 of them, and each one more fascinating than the next. Thank you so much for joining us. Mazal tov on the book. I think it's amazing, and I think every single chapter is worth reading.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be with you today.
I appreciate that. Rabbi Shlomo Brody, A Guide to the Complex. You can check it out. Go to korenpub.com, Koren Publications, korenpub.com. And, of course, it's a Magid Books release, which is a... associated with Koren Publications. You have been listening to Buy the Book here at the Nachum Segal Network. Check out our social media on Facebook, Nachum Segal Network, on Twitter at Nachum Segal Net, on Instagram, Nachum Segal Network. And every single Wednesday at 9:30 Eastern Time, you're treated to another amazing offer, courtesy of our friends at Koren Publications. On this segment, we entitled Buy the Book here at the Nachum Segal Network. Thank you.